St. Patrick Hospital announces new services that add to the changing medical landscape in Missoula. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a potential new biomass energy facility on the Flathead Reservation. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with aging expert Louis Tenenbaum about what it takes to successfully age in place. More big changes are in store for hospital medical care in Missoula. Providence St. Patrick Hospital announced today it is adding comprehensive women's and children's services, including obstetrical and newborn care, and a Level 2 neonatal intensive care unit. The new services will duplicate services at Missoula's other hospital, Community Medical Center, and the announcement comes in the wake of community's recent decision to become a for-profit hospital under the new ownership of the Billings Clinic and Regional Care Network. St. Pat's CEO Jeff Fee told News Director Sally Mock this afternoon that St. Pat's is adding the new services in part because of the impact of the Affordable Care Act and because of community's decision to become a for-profit hospital.
When I first got here in August 2006, we were in the process of opening up an obstetrics unit. And I got here, I landed, and one of the first things I did is I stopped it, primarily because there was this big push from the community at large for the two hospitals to try to figure out a way to work collaboratively together. And so I've really spent the last 7 years and 8 months trying to figure out ways to make that work. We made the decision 2 years ago that we needed to get back into women and children's, which was a reversal of my initial decision. We put that decision on hold pending, you know, ramped up conversations that we've been having all along with Community Medical Center. And really held on that decision until we had clarity around what their intentions were relative to maintaining a competitive marketplace in Western Montana.
Whether they were going to merge with you or somebody else.
We weren't ever considering a merger per se. It was more of an affiliation type of alignment model. But we've been having those conversations really, like I said, since I got here.
There are two trains of thought about when two hospitals are in the same place and they offer the same services. One is that the consumer will benefit because it will be more competition. The other is that the market's too small to support duplication.
Well, we had always maintained the disposition that when it comes to tertiary services, the high-end care that we're so fortunate to have here in Missoula, that we did not, and we still don't necessarily believe that the community size, our population, can't support two comprehensive tertiary service providers. There's just not enough volume to keep two high-end care centers going, given the fact that we're seeing utilization rates for cardiac cath, open heart surgery, and we're going to start seeing that happen with other high-end procedures continue to go down as we get more effective at our population management efforts. So, yes, we've historically and continue to this day have concerns about two comprehensive service providers being able to survive and thrive in this marketplace.
Yet that's the course you're going down.
It is the course we're going down because we have a competitive landscape that is changing very dramatically. I spent 16 years in the for-profit industry. I understand how for-profit healthcare works, and we have a competitive environment that's been introduced in Missoula, Montana that we haven't experienced before. We've been here for 140 years, and it's our intention that we'll be here 140 years from now, providing excellent healthcare and hopefully doing a better job providing healthcare than we are today.
Well, I've been speaking with Jeff Fee of Providence St. Patrick Hospital. Mr. Fee, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Fee says St. Pat's hopes to have the new services available no later than June of next year. Community Medical Center did not respond to a request for comment, but issued a statement saying they are, quote, saddened to hear the news of St. Patrick's move into obstetrics and neonatal intensive care.
And in other news, Missoula County Commissioner Michelle Langquist says work is underway to streamline the county's growth policy to, in her words, quote, make things make more sense and make it more business-friendly. Langquist spoke before a crowd of about 200 people today during the City Club State of the Community presentation. City Club is an organization that sponsors nonpartisan public forums on a variety of local issues. Langquist also addressed an audience member's opinion about the adversarial relationship the county seems to have with its residents and business operators. The county's been accused by some of being heavy-handed and too quick to sue when enforcing local regulations. Lenquist says updating local growth policy should help reduce that friction, but she also maintains that members of the public sometimes refuse to take steps to resolve the conflict.
So some of that's a moving target. There's many, many sides to that story, and a new county attorney in town, I'm sure, is going to help facilitate some of those changes as well as changes in our regulations.
Missoula Mayor John Ingen used part of his time at the podium to forcefully defend the city's move to obtain its privately owned water system through eminent domain. The city had unsuccessfully tried to negotiate a purchase of Mountain Water Company from its owner, the Carlisle Group.
It means the world to the future of our community, and that is why we're sticking our necks out here in pursuing the purchase of this asset. This is a community asset, and I think the board of directors ought to live right here in Missoula, Montana, and I think that board of directors ought to be elected by all of you ratepayers, citizens, in order to ensure that this fundamental resource in our community remains sustainable, remains affordable, and simply remains.
Ingen also used his time to stump for creation of a public safety and justice task district in Missoula for improved police department facilities and fire trucks. University of Montana President Royce Engstrom addressed the school's enrollment, which has dipped to pre-recession levels. Engstrom says UM is redoubling its recruitment work. He says it's also revising its strategy to awarding financial aid to help attract the best students possible. Once they're here, Engstrom says UM wants to give those students the best chance at academic success. He pointed to the difficulties students across the nation have with math.
Well, recently, our School of Education, our Office of Student Success, and our math department worked with the Montana Digital Academy to pilot something called EdReady. It's an online approach to helping students in developmental math situations improve their math skills. In that pilot study, the students in that study all increased their math skills by 1, 2, or even 3 course levels, avoiding the need for developmental math. They were able to go right into college-level math. Well, now, with the help of the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, which gave us a grant for $2.4 million, we're going to apply EdReady on a statewide basis.
Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg says he will not file any charges in connection with the avalanche that killed one person and injured 2 others in Missoula in February. Van Valkenburg says there was no evidence of criminal intent or criminal negligence on the part of 4 young men who were snowboarding and sledding on Mount Jumbo when the avalanche occurred.
The Wolf Point School District has agreed to redraw its voting districts for school board elections after an ACLU lawsuit argued for the district's favored white voters in a predominantly Native American area. The ACLU said today the settlement approved on April 9th calls for reducing the total number of school board members and redrawing districts so they all include nearly the same number of residents. The ACLU filed the lawsuit after learning that members of the majority white voting district had been electing one board member for every 143 residents, while those in the Native American district had been electing one board member for every 841 residents. The Wolf Point School website says 80% of its students are Native Americans.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribal Corporation that is managing the acquisition of Kerr Dam is also looking into the feasibility of building a biomass energy plant on the Flathead Reservation. Brian Lipscomb is CEO of Energy Keepers Incorporated. He says the tribe has just received an $800,000 grant from the Department of Energy to study if such a plant is feasible.
In our early planning with the acquisition of the Kerr facility, we realized we should think of a little more than that and see if there were any other opportunities that might make sense for us to develop along with the Kerr project. We actually looked at small hydro, we looked at some wind, some solar, geothermal, of course over by Hot Springs we have some opportunities there, and biomass.
Lipscomb says some early feasibility studies showed biomass penciled out as the best option to explore further. Biomass energy requires a steady supply of wood, and that supply is one of the issues to be explored.
The fuel supply for biomass plant is a primary factor for considering its feasibility into the future. The feasibility studies that we're looking at actually looks at 2 opportunities, one using on-reservation waste from forest management activities. The other would look at combining that with also some additional off-reservation waste from forest management activities.
Lipscomb says they hope to have the feasibility study done by August.
Governor Steve Bullock is asking President Barack Obama to issue a federal disaster declaration for Montana due to widespread flooding and ice jams last month. Bullock's letter, dated Friday, explains that the unusually high amounts of precipitation that fell over the winter and cold weather allowed thick ice to develop on rivers and streams, so when the snow melted quickly early March, it caused ice jams and flooding. Bullock says the flooding caused widespread damage to roads, culverts, bridges, and public buildings. He says the costs of responding to the recent flooding have exceeded the state's resources. 15 counties declared an emergency or a disaster, 7 towns declared an emergency, while the Crow, Northern Cheyenne, and Blackfeet reservations also sought assistance. Federal funds are not available to pay for private property damage.
UN President Engstrom also participated today in a listening session that featured U.S. Senator John Walsh, who recently signed on to a federal student loan refinancing bill. It would allow those repaying federal student loans at interest rates above 4% to refinance to a fixed rate of 4%. The Democrat says that if implemented, the measure would provide students and their families more predictability as they enter the workforce. In Montana, 64% of students from four-year programs graduate with some amount of debt. The average student will leave with $26,400 in student loans. That's slightly higher than the national average of $25,000. Walsh says our young people are our most valuable natural resource in the state.
But we're having to export a lot of our resources outside of the state of Montana after they graduate because they're graduating with a significant amount of debt. And so when we talk about creating jobs in the state of Montana, we want to create better paying jobs so that when those our young men and women are graduating from college, they don't have to leave the state in order to be able to pay their student loans off.
Other participants of today's listening session brought their own ideas. Those included more financial literacy classes to help students before they get too entrenched in debt. Another suggested more responsive veteran benefit dispersal on behalf of the Veterans Administration. More dual credit programs generated support during today's session. Such programs enable high school juniors and seniors to take advanced classes and earn credit simultaneously for high school and college. One student also pitched an idea of student debt forgiveness for successful young entrepreneurs who emerge from the Montana university system.
A new nonprofit corporation has been formed to carry out Evel Knievel Days in Butte after previous organizers backed out during a struggle over control of the festival with the Knievels family. Attorney Rick Orizzotti says Evel Knievel Days Incorporated was recently formed to plan, promote, and conduct Evel Knievel Days in Butte each year. This year's event is set for July 24th through the 26th. 11 people have been named to the board of directors, including Knievel's former wife, Crystal Knievel. They plan to meet this week. The dispute over the festival began when Kelly Knievel sought a new licensing agreement with Butte Silverbow County for the use of his father's name. Organizers with Evel Knievel Week Incorporated backed out last week, in part over threats Kelly Knievel made to its executive director.
Thirteen 13% of the American population is over 65 years old, and the average life expectancy by 2020 is projected to be 80. Add to those facts a decreasing number of people available to care for the elderly, and you have what many gerontologists believe is a looming crisis. Most of those elderly do not want to go to an assisted living facility or a nursing home. They want to grow old and die at home, but few are planning how best to do that. Louis Tenenbaum is the founder of the Aging in Place Institute and was a keynote speaker at the Montana Gerontology Society conference held recently in Missoula. In this feature interview, Tenenbaum talks with news director Sally Mock about some of the ways people can up their chances of being able to grow old in the home they choose.
The biggest misconception is that you stay in the house you've lived in for a long time. But people choose to move for lifestyle. Sometimes they move to be near recreation or near a university or near their family or further from their family. But then when a health incident occurs, too often people aren't able to return to their home. And that's when it's not aging in place, when you're forced to move from the home you've chosen because something happens in your health, something essentially expectable that then really changes your life.
And you don't just move once, actually. You might go from your home to the hospital and then into a rehab institution, maybe back home, and then to assisted living. There's lots of moves involved sometimes.
There are lots of moves, and we're trying to avoid the ones that are the assisted living type moves and the nursing home type moves. So if your home is prepared well, not only is it a place that reduces your risks of falling and so forth, but it's a place where you can return more easily from rehab, and then your rehab is cheaper, and your rehab is probably quicker because you're in your own environment, you feel good, you're in control. And it's also a place, hopefully, where if or when you need care, it's a place where that care can be given safely, ergonomically for the caregiver. So the caregiver, whether it's a family member or someone who's paid, isn't hurt while they're helping you out in the house.
So tell me some of the things that you need to do in your home. I mean, some of the obvious things that we all think of is like having a bar in the shower, having chairs that lift you up and that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. Those are assistive technologies, bars in the shower. But they're not assistive technologies if you put them in before you need them. So a really important idea is to take care of these things as precautions and just as good design. So the main things we think about are how you enter and exit, you know, safely and without steps, how you move around within the house, whether it's using stairs or getting up and down the stairs or maneuvering through doorways and that the lighting is good, how you get to a full bath and bedroom and the storage associated with each of them, into and out of bed, on and off the toilet, up to the sink and get bathed, where you get your meals and how you prepare them. How you entertain, whether it's watching television or reading or listening to music or having guests, how you do your home office function, which is really important. Everybody has mail to sift through and bills to pay, and often a lot of people need a place where they can comfortably pack and take their pills. And then one thing that's really important to most people is how they enjoy the outdoors. So I've had people actually say to me, well, if you can't get me in my garden, I might as well go to that darn nursing home. Because people want a way to enjoy the outdoors. So we use assistive technologies like lift chairs or like grab bars, but also no step entries. I don't say ramps because I usually try to change the landscaping and make it just look like a good normal home, but happen to not have any steps into it.
You mentioned caregivers because that's a key part of someone being able to live independently through illness, for example, or serious injury. And that's a problem. I mean, there are home care services, but there aren't nearly enough for what's going to be required, are there?
There aren't nearly enough services, and there aren't nearly enough caregivers.
And they're not affordable necessarily.
Well, they're not necessarily affordable, but family caregivers actually give the bulk of the care in this country. Some estimates are that it's $450 billion worth of value, but it's not charged, and we need to support that. But also, as longevity increases and the boomer cohort moves into older age, what's called the caregiver ratio is getting very bad. Where we used to have five family members, one or two of which could help with mom and dad, now we only have one or two.
And they may live
thousands of miles away. And the fact is that people are living longer. So in the past 40 years, for example, and I cite 40 because in 1975, my dad was 55 years old, and he retired with enough money to live to age 72. And this is 1975, and he said, who lives past 72? And I didn't argue with him. I didn't say, oh, Dad, that's ridiculous. But my father died at 89, and that's no longer uncommon. But just 40 years ago, that was uncommon. So now we have many older people. And when you're older,
13% of the population over 65.
And it's growing partly because of this boomer cohort, but also because of longevity. But when you're older, you need more care. You need more assistance. So though we might say independent is really a misnomer for proximity because we're always in, you know, proximity. I don't milk the cow, but I use milk in my coffee every morning. So I'm in proximity in some way to a system that backs me up.
But to go back to how do we solve the lack of caregiver problem?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing we can do is train more people better. And we can reduce the caregiver burden by, for example, if you have a bathroom where you can get into the bathroom safely without assistance, then you don't need that caregiver. So you have, in fact, by using equipment or design – better, you've reduced the need for care. That's really an important concept.
Do you see this need being met in time to avoid what many gerontologists think is a coming crisis in terms of care for the elderly?
That's the $64,000 question. Like many things we face individually and as a nation, we don't plan very well. So part of my work now is trying to raise awareness of this issue. One of the things I've been saying is, you know, many of us are aware that Al Gore helped bring climate and sustainability issues higher in the public's awareness. And I'm now thinking, you know, that was Al Gore-ifying sustainability. We need to maybe Joe Biden-ize adult care, older caregiver issues, because we don't pay quite enough attention to it.
Well, I've been speaking with Louis Tenenbaum, and he's founder of the Aging in Place Institute. He's a consultant on these aging in place issues. And one of the statistics, I think, Mr. Tenenbaum, that I found most interesting is that people fear losing their independence way more than they fear death.
Exactly. One study showed 26% of people fear losing their independence, 3% fear death. So when you deliver your family member to an assisted living or a nursing home, you're actually, in their opinion, delivering them to a fate worse than death. And when you do that, you feel guilty, you feel bad, and a whole lot about the family dynamic really breaks down over these issues.
Mr. Tenenbaum, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and a slight chance of thunderstorms with highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. For central Montana, there is a winter weather advisory in effect from 6 a.m. tomorrow to 6 p.m. Wednesday for the Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade, central and southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, and Maher counties. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and mountain snow showers and highs 45 to 55 degrees. Southwest Montana tonight, you should expect winter weather advisory in effect from 6 a.m. tomorrow to 6 p.m. Wednesday for Madison, Broadwater, and Gallatin counties. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 25 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain and snow with highs 45 to 55 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farling.
Never underestimate how some politicians care more about blind ideology than the interests of the very people they purport to care about. A number of lawmakers and county commissioners are working to kill a proposed compact that will settle for all time the legitimate claims the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes have to water in the state. Among the stars of this effort are Montana Senators Verdell Jackson of Kalispell, Jennifer Fielder of Thompson Falls, Chaz Vinson of Libby, and Janet Taylor of Dayton, as well as Representatives Nancy Balance of the Bitterroot and Keith Regier of Kalispell, and of course, the Ravalli County Commission. They have assumed the mantle of savior for existing water users, primarily irrigators on and off the Flathead Reservation, claiming that the water compact, the result of years of transparent negotiation among the tribes, state of Montana, and federal government, is unconstitutional, based on flawed interpretation of treaties and legal precedent. They reflexively claim it robs existing users of water rights. Many parrot the vacuous rhetoric of an opposition group with the unreasonable-sounding name of the Western Montana Water Users Association, a shadowy organization that doesn't reveal who is steering and funding it. The association brays about liberty, property rights, and how Native Americans are supposedly disenfranchising non-tribal members. Its primary expert appears to be a Wyoming hydrologist whose history includes, among other peculiar interests, a stint as a leader in the anti-Obama birther movement. Importantly, they are all spectacularly wrong. They insist the accord be nixed, which will only result in significant risk and legal complications for existing water users across western and central Montana. If the compact fails because the next Montana legislature listens to these folks and declines to ratify the accord, the tribe's alternative will be go to Montana's water court with their claims to leave water in stream for protecting the fish they are guaranteed by treaty. And because treaty guarantees extend beyond the Flathead Indian Reservation and include Aboriginal rights on places historically hunted and fished, they could rightfully claim water be left in stream to protect fish populations as far east as Billings on the Yellowstone River or below Great Falls in the Missouri. Certainly, they have inarguable Aboriginal claims off-reservation in the Salish homeland of the Bitterroot Valley or the lands historically fished and hunted by the Kootenai and Ponderay peoples on the lower Clark Fork and Kootenai River drainages. If the court adjudicates these claims in the tribe's favor, it will create chaos in Montana's first-in-time, first-in-right appropriation system. That's because the tribe's rights date back to either time immemorial or 1855, the date of the Hellgate Treaty, placing them first in line for the water they want left in stream. Essentially, then, all existing claims, permits, and uses of water in half of Montana could eventually be subordinate to tribal rights. That would be great for fish, but create mayhem in Montana's long-held system of water use priorities. Compact opponents indignantly claim the tribes are unreasonable by citing this as an alternative. Not really. The tribes would only be exercising the very same solution, seeking resolution of their rights in water court, which virtually every other water right claimant in the state is doing. Opponents should explain, then, why there should be a lesser standard for Native Americans. It's possible the tribes might not prevail in court, but don't bet on it. In the least, it will confound final adjudication of thousands of water rights for decades in half the state, while clouding future development on the reservation, where the state is prohibited by the courts from approving new groundwater wells and stream diversions. The anti-compact legislators and commissioners are really fighting for chaos and unnecessarily creating risk for thousands of existing water users. Their counterparts in the Clark Fork, Kootenai, and Upper Yellowstone and Missouri River basins, whose constituents aren't affected by the compact, should think deeply before supporting the anti-compact forces. Some legislators understand this and have courageously defended the compact in the face of furious personal attacks, most notably Flathead legislators Representative Dan Solomon and Senator Bruce Tutvett, and Missoulian Senator Dick Barrett. That's because they know the compact protects all existing uses of water on reservation while creating modest opportunities for the tribes to protect stream flows for fish. Off reservation, the compact leaves all existing water rights whole. The tribes have conceded much in the compact. They propose giving up forever their legitimate claims to water across half of Montana. It's a gracious concession from gracious people. As for the alternative, the axiom, be careful what you wish for, couldn't be more appropriate. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.